Hi, everybody, and welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's Neuroscience Research Podcast. Today is November 9th, 2023, and we're talking to Ann West, who is professor in the departments of neurobiology and cell biology at Duke University. She works on epigenetics, brain development, and plasticity, and developmental diseases. Hi, Ann, welcome.
Why, thank you very much.
Also with us today is Alexey Soshnev, our local UTSA histone biologist and epigenetics expert. Hi, Alexey.
Hi, good to be here.
And me, I'm Charlie Wilson. So, Ann, most neurons undergo this long developmental process, a lot of it postnatal, in which they have to do a lot of things, migrate into the right place, send out their axons and dendrites to the right, into the right shape in the right place, sometimes for a long way, and express the right ion channels to have the electrical properties they have to, the transmitters, the receptors, and all that stuff has to happen in sequence, and it does happen in sequence. We know that, that things happen just at the right time and in a sequence, and the sequence is, if it gets messed up, the development is messed up. So that means that all these different genes get expressed at different times during development, going well into, even in humans, even probably into 10, 20 years old. Mm-hmm. So, it's a mystery how that happens, has been a mystery from the beginning, and recognized by everybody as a weird truth about the nervous system. But we almost forget because it's such a hard problem to solve. So that's what epigenetics is all of that stuff. So can you tell us what the field of epigenetics has to offer in the way of an explanation at this point, and maybe something about where we can hope?
So, you know, I think when I started working in this area, the thing that struck me is I thought back to developmental biology, right? I was trained in developmental neurobiology. So if you think about development, we all know that we all begin as one cell. And then that cell, through processes of division, becomes all the different cells in the body. And that works because every cell has the same genome, but every cell uses the same genome a little bit differently. And during the past 10 and 20 years, we've been able to use DNA sequencing and sequencing for different kinds of epigenetic marks to understand how that works, how one cell can use one genome and use that to turn into all these different cell types. And we're very good at this now. We can do single cell sequencing, we can do it out of the brain and identify all the different cell types and see all the different genes they express and the ways in which chromatin is differently organized. So chromatin being essentially genomic DNA and the way it's packaged around histone proteins, which are the major proteins that sort of give the structure and the shape to the chromatin. And so we can see regions that are open and can be regulated and turned on in different cells. And that was great. You know, this has been a really sort of well understood process of what the epigenome is, that it's a particular set of chromatin modifications to DNA, modifications to the histone proteins, that change the structure and the state of genomic DNA in the nucleus of a single cell. But how does that explain what you just told me? You just said, yeah, but neurons are postmitotic. We're born with the neurons that we have for the rest of our lives. And yet we can still learn things. Our brains can still change. They can function differently over time. And how do you do that with neurons that already have a particular complement of DNA structured in a particular way? They're already neurons, but yet they can still adapt to the world around them. And so that became the question I was really interested in, trying to figure out ways to look at neurons over time when they're doing different kinds of things and use all those same methods and concepts that we discovered from understanding how the epigenome changes the regulation of the genome during development and try and apply that to postmitotic neurons in the brain and understand whether similar or different mechanisms might be important in the brain. Because the truth is that, like, not everything that happens in one cell type is actually relevant in another. As you sort of mentioned, like, sometimes a mutation in a gene, I think it was you mentioned this, sometimes a mutation in a fundamental gene, a component of chromatin, might affect one cell type and not another cell type at all. So things might not be shared, but they might be. And so with the advent of fast, cheap, easy, affordable sequencing, that you could sort of look at the structure of the epigenome in a lot of different kinds of neurons at many different time points, this became suddenly a question that you could go out there and ask. And so much of my career in neuroscience has been really trying to ask that question, trying to find ways to look at the structure and the state of chromatin in postmitotic neurons and understand how it's changing and why, and what relevance that has for what neurons can do.
So one level of asking the question is to just pick a gene that needs to be expressed at a particular time in development and asking, what are the detailed mechanics of expressing that at that moment? You might think, well, at least I could do that. To think of doing that for every gene that needs doing might seem daunting, but doing it for one of them seems doable. So what's a good example of something
that's been done that way? I can think of two things that come to mind, and I'd be curious which examples come to your mind, too.
I mean, FOSS comes to my mind right away,
because
everyone studies FOSS, everyone studies ARC.
So we're thinking right now, one way we could think about this is activity-regulated genes. Exactly. So neurons can change which genes they express by modifying the function of transcription factors that bind to the promoters of genes that need to be turned on when activity changes. And one of the best examples is the gene FOSS. So FOSS itself it's called an immediate early gene, was identified as being a gene that goes up in cells, so actually when they become infected with viruses long, long ago, it was thought that it might be some form of an oncogene. But later it's been shown in all cells it responds to outside stimuli. It's just downstream of transcription factors that can be phosphorylated by signaling cascades, that can be activated by cell surface membranes. So it's inducibly expressed, it does its thing, and then it goes away. And so FOSS turns on in neurons in response to neural activity. That was first discovered in the 80s through calcium signaling pathways. It turns on in other cell types through other signaling pathways. But it's possible to identify all the transcription factors that bind to the FOSS promoter. That was done through sort of transcription factor bashing. You bash through the promoter and mutate different regions, figure out which ones are required. It's been done by, overexpressing those transcription factors, showing that they can regulate FOSS. This is actually fascinating. It's one of my favorite papers. But in the very first genome-wide sequencing paper that was done in neurons was actually done by T.K. Kim, when he was with Mike Greenberg when they were in Boston. And he looked at a couple of different things, but the key thing that he looked at was nuclear RNA. He was able to identify these small enhancer RNAs. They're non-coding RNAs that are made at regulatory elements of genes. And when he looked at the FOSS gene, sure, he could see some in the promoter of the FOSS gene, but he identified these five distal regions that were tens of thousands of base pairs away. And he was the first one to really show that neural activity wasn't just landing on a single gene in a single place at that promoter, but that there were these distal enhancer regions that were far away from the gene that were also being activated at the same time the gene was, and that's the binding sites for activity-regulated transcription factors, and that they loop together in space to be close to the promoter of that gene. So that was really kind of a breakthrough paper in the neurobiology field, because I think we'd been so focused on gene promoters as being where the information was, and that paper showed us we had to think about distal regions. Yeah.
I was just going to say that looking at a single gene and a single promoter at a time is potentially incredibly fruitful, and you can uncover a lot of very basic biology this way. And obviously, since the 70s, many labs have been doing this in simpler model systems and now in more complex ones. But what happens is you end up pigeonholing yourself into this very narrow view of everything as promoter-centric. And promoters constitute less than 0.00001% of the genome. And so you might know the very fundamental mechanisms of the promoter, but if you don't understand how that fits into the context of the broader genome, it's not even meaningless information, it's almost misleading information.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, you might come up with a model and then it will be fairly often false.
You know, the most interesting thing to me, thinking back about FOSS, because FOSS was where we really understood the functions of Krebs. So Krebs is a transcription factor well understood in the nervous system, regulated by calcium signaling, important in survival and in learning and memory to some degree, although SRF perhaps more so, to my SRF friends. But Krebs was very well understood as a regulator of FOS. But then they did CHIP for Krebs, actually. So CHIP is chromatin immunoprecipitation, an antibody against Krebs, pulling it down, trying to see where it's bound across the genome. And the results of that study were stunning, actually, because most of the Krebs was not found at gene promoters. That was the very first, I'm going to say this, but it might not be completely correct, it's one of the very first chromatin IP experiments done in mammalian cell. It had been done in Drosophila before, that had been done in yeast. But this was done in a mammalian cell. And so there were two possibilities from that data. Either we're thinking about Krebs all wrong, and that it's functioning way away from genes, or the method wasn't working. Like maybe the method just was nonspecific, and at the time no one was very sure. And I remember a relatively famous transcription biologist came, I'm not gonna say who it is, came and was at where it was a postdoc, and we had lunch with this person, and I said to them, I'm like, what percentage of transcription factor binding sites do you think are at gene promoters? And they said, I think most of them are there. And I'm like, why? And he said, that's because that's where we see them. And I'm like, well, that's where we've been looking, right? Yeah. And so this was an example where that idea really wasn't right, because that's just where we kept looking. And chromatin sequencing allowed us to understand, to see that that there was a lot more out there. Think about the question differently.
Absolutely. And when it comes down to transcription factor binding sites specifically, I have another bone to pick with the transcription factor community about that, is that consider a typical transcription factor in the human genome binds a 6, 7, 8 base pair consensus, which is often fairly relaxed. There is fluctuations allowed at individual bases. So how often does a 8 base pair sequence happen in a human genome?
Really often.
Really often. You just do the math. It's a 4^8, right? Because you have 4 positions at each nucleotide. So you have hundreds of thousands of individual binding sites in the genome. But if you map an actual transcription factor going unbiased experiment data, you usually find that the transcription factor binds 5,000 sites, maybe 10,000 sites. Mm-hmm. So what about the remaining 400,000 binding sites which are not occupied? They have the exact same DNA sequence. And that tells you that DNA sequence alone is not the only thing that drives the binding, and probably not the only thing that drives activity. Because here's another thing, 5,000 binding sites for a transcription factor, you knock it out, you have 300 genes that change.
Yeah.
So are the remaining 4,700 binding sites meaningless? Do they do nothing? Do they do something in a different context that we just haven't assayed correctly? These are all questions for epigenetics.
So how does that, it sounds like what you've been talking about are things that happen to the chromatin that's available for expression and not to the chromatin that is not because of some epigenetic modification.
Right.
So that's, I guess, the transcription factors and promoters are something that we would normally present to students as how the control of gene expression happens, but it's puzzling, and sometimes students even raise the problem of it seems like you need so many transcription factors to create that complex sequence of gene expression in any cell, but especially in a neuron. So is there a higher level of organization that can orchestrate all of that stuff?
Yeah, and I hear a couple interesting questions in there, so
okay, good.
I'll start in one place and then go on. But, you know, just to say, a lot of what we know about gene regulation, we've learned from other organisms, right? We've learned from yeast, or we've learned from worms and flies, where we have beautiful genetics to explain to us how things work. And one of the things that's quite striking about those organisms is that actually it is mostly about transcription factors binding at promoters. There's a lot of that goes on. I just think of like some of the original sort of systems that we learned even from bacteria, you know, these operons and how they function. So things that we learned about gene regulation that really were very direct. And that is all indeed true. But the mammalian genome is really weird because it's gigantic, and it's got all these huge introns and these regulatory places that just wasn't really understood. And we knew that there were binding sites for transcription factors all over the place, that didn't seem to get used. And I remember when there was a paper that came out from a wonderful CREB lab working on CREB again that said, wow, this is really surprising that there's so many of these binding sites that aren't occupied. Why is that? And it really took, I think the thing that's really important to understand about our thinking about the nucleus, and you were in, you know, ground zero of this, is that a lot of it has to do with what we understand about the nucleus is driven by the technologies that we have to understand the nucleus. And so as sequencing technologies became available, we started to learn things. So we learned about where the transcription factors were bound. That was something that we were learning in the sort of maybe early 2000s. We were learning where transcription factors were bound. But around the same time, there were these methods developed that would show where those transcription factors could bind. We talked about chromatin being open and accessible. It was well known that the histone proteins were super important and that they were bound to the genomic DNA and they played important roles. And people had been looking at genomic DNA for a long time structurally and knew there were different kinds of fibers that were wrapped at different levels. They knew about heterochromatin and euchromatin. But when we could actually see using sequencing exactly where the nucleosomes had gotten out of the way so that a transcription factor could bind, that was really, to me, that was a huge thing. So the development of methods that were DNA-seq originally, the FAIR-seq methods as well, and then it should become ATAC-seq over time. But these are really key things. That's been a level of organization for helping us understand where chromatin is available to be bound, where DNA can be bound, and where it cannot, because there's a competition between transcription factors, which basically don't bind DNA very strongly, which also has to do with the sequence specificity. We can get into that. That's a fun story. And nucleosomes, which actually bind quite tightly and really give the structure to chromatin.
And then there's, of course, a love-hate relationship between chromatin and transcription factors, because for a lot of, especially early studies, chromatin was considered to be the anti-transcription factor setup, because if you have chromatinized template, you don't want to bind there. You can't bind there. You can't access the DNA. And then, of course, we learned more about the pioneer factors, which are generally insensitive to chromatin compaction levels and, in fact, might prefer compacted chromatin. And then we're learning about transcription factors that would contain an additional domain on them that would recognize a certain modification on the chromatin. And the chromatin domain, chromatin binding domain, would then direct the DNA binding domain or the other way around to reinforce and increase the specificity for binding at specific site. So it's none of that is black and white. All of that is actually fairly complex and sometimes is very cell type and transcription factor specific. I was going to say that it's probably not quite surprising that probably about 10% of human genes encode transcription factors.
Yeah.
So with us having about 23-ish thousand genes, I think we're looking at roughly 2,000 plus transcription factors encoded in the human genome. And then, for the most part, no gene is regulated by a single transcription factor. Absolute majority are regulated by combinations of dozens, if not more. And so the logic there is way more complex. It's not a simple if A, then B. It's a logic gate with 50 inputs, which also control the strength of the input. And I like to compare it to very much like Harmonica Hall drawings of the cortex and then current drawings of the neural network with all these hidden layers. Transcription regulation works very much the same way, mm-hmm. that there is multiple hidden layers where all these transcription factors, chromatin states, interact with each other and ultimately converge on an output.
So one of the most remarkable things about these neural networks is that we can't understand them. And so I'm a little worried when you say that. If it works like that, then can we sort it out? Like I was kind of having a fun time here enjoying the idea that transcription factors are redundant and that there are many places that they could act, but they don't act at all of those at the same time because the histones are choosing where they their binding sites are available and where they're not. And that creates a nice two-layer system of control, and that's very satisfying, but that what you just said sounds like something that might never be sorted out.
Well, I'm going to go with this. I was just going to say, I think we should break the questions down into a few parts, and maybe we can build towards that, because I would say we've made a lot more progress, as you said, on that first mm-hmm. side, on understanding the chromatin landscape, on understanding about sort of generally, you know, the relationship between histone modifications or DNA modifications or even structure of chromatin, which is sort of the histones and the DNA together, and how that influences transcription in general. This question of the regulatory logic of how transcription factors work together to regulate genes and how that is influenced by place, that's the real question. That's the fascinating question. And, you know, how that's going to work, I don't know. And I think, you know, possibly, this is my opinion, and I think we can come back to this, this is why this is be interesting to come through, is this is a field that's been very methods driven. As there's been a new development, a new methods development, we got to talk about the histone code here, because that was so huge in terms of our way of thinking about sort of the relationship between chromatin and transcription in general. The histone code was key. The next phase, when we get to this regulatory logic of multiple transcription factors and how that works, that's really gotta require some new way of thinking. So I've seen, yeah, one really beautiful paper that has addressed this literally for four transcription factors at one time point. And I think that there are beautiful ways that you can do this, but we're gonna have to simplify the systems. But yeah, you had another.
I think the word we're looking for is functional genomics.
Yeah.
Because we don't do genetics anymore, we don't do genomics. And genomics is when we can perturb every single gene of interest at the same time and track functional outcomes over time. Usually it's done in tissue culture because that's at least manageable. But if you can target every single gene in the human genome with multiple redundant guide RNAs and then track functional outcomes and then track sensitivity to drugs, physiology of the cell, metabolism of the cell, all these measurable outcomes, you all of a sudden can reconstruct this very complex network in a meaningful and quantifiable way. So on one hand, I absolutely agree that, yes, it sounds like an absolutely mind-boggling problem, but if we approach it from quantifiable, measurable angles, there are ways to untangle it. It's just, it's not going to be overnight. It's probably going to be a different layered network in different cell types at different cell stages. But we'll get there. I'm optimistic.
So one of the things you just said is about sequencing what happens over time. So
right.
In the neuron, there are these this sort of timeline for the cell. It has to go through these stages at all these times. It's probably true for every cell, but in neurons, this gets extended over an incredible long period of time. And in fact, you can send the neuron off into some other direction and make it follow a different timeline, even in adults, with some kind of a treatment. So what's programming that? I mean, I've already asked a hard question, like what's programming it? But let me ask a little harder question about what's programming the sequences of of things? Why a gene gets turned on and then later it gets turned off and some other one? Are they like this one triggers that one and that one triggers the next one in a long line, or is it some like pre-programmed thing so that if you missed a step, you could catch up with yourself?
Can I very quickly tell a fascinating story about neurons specifically?
Yeah.
So in histones, every amino acid matters. And there's two isoforms broadly of histone H3. H3 is a core component of the nucleosome. H3.1 or 2 contain an alanine at that position, if I remember correctly, and H3.3 contains a serine at that position. Position is 31 on the tail. Now, H3.1 and 2 are your average histones that get synthesized during the cell cycle. That's when 95% of your histones get synthesized, and your regular cell contains H3.1 and H3.2, and a little bit of H3.3. Neurons are not like that, because neurons exited the cell cycle, and they don't synthesize any more DNA, so they don't synthesize your regular run-of-the-mill histones anymore. They synthesize H3.3. So in neurons, as they age, the chromatin slowly replaces H3.1 and 2, which contain alanine in that position, with a H3.3, which contains a serine in that position. And serine contains a hydroxyl group which can get phosphorylated. And so if you're getting phosphorylated at that position, all of a sudden you can activate enhancers, you can activate promoters, you can activate lots of very exciting function in the genome just by virtue of having this essentially neuron-specific, not quite neuron-specific, but a very much enriched in neurons histone variant that happens to progressively enrich itself over the lifetime of the neuron.
You know, this is the thing that blew me away. As a cell biologist, I was basically trained as a cell biologist, right? So even though I was a neurobiologist, the neurobiology always likes to think that we're very special and different. So when I was a grad student, we were interested in the mechanisms of vesicle release, for instance. And the strategy that everyone took is they would take synaptic vesicles from neurons, and they injected them into mice and raised antibodies against them. And then they would take the antibodies and they would find the antibodies that recognize neurons and nothing else, no other vesicles, right? Just neurons. And so this is the whole concept. We're looking for the things that are special, that neurons are different. And then finally, around the, it was 1994, they identified the vesicle release machinery, the snaps and the snares. And it was done by James Rothman, who was studying vesicle transfer in Golgi. Because it turns out that actually the proteins are conserved. And all vesicle release happens to be actually highly conserved. It's just that neurons have a lot of it. And so it was easy to purify the proteins from synaptic vesicles. And so for me, that was this time, was I was like, okay, important functions are conserved between cells. They're not different. So here I was, and a neurobiologist, sort of becoming this person who understood that things are conserved. And then we get to the nucleus. So, of course, you're starting to think, okay, well, the nucleus, all these fundamental mechanisms, DNA methylation, histone modifications, they must be conserved. And yet, these things start coming out. So hydroxymethylation was the first one, was identified, it was the fifth base, right? So there's the sixth base, sorry. Because there's the four bases, A, C, G, and T, and then there's methyl C. And then there was hydroxymethyl C, and that was first identified, well, I'm not going to say first. One of the places it was first identified was in Purkinje neurons, because it's very prominent there. And it is quite prominent in the nervous system. Then the H3.3, the fact that there were the histones, and then methylation of CA residues. So normally we always think of CGs in the genome as being methylated, but in neurons, after birth, it comes up after birth, for heaven's sakes, it's so late. Then you see as much CA methylation in neurons as you have CG methylation. So neurons have twice as much methylation as do other cell types. That's mind-blowing, right?
Can I very quickly say one more thing? That in organisms that only have one isoform of H3, H3.3 is the one that they have.
So it's other cells that are strange.
It's the other cells that are strange. Neurons are the original guys.
Yeah,
neurons. The serine in position 31. It's the OG amino acid.
Wow. Mm-hmm. But this is the idea, is neurons actually do have an epigenome that's different from other cells.
That is entirely true, yes.
And that's amazing.
Do we have any hints about what particular features that enables the neuron to do?
My guess is that I'm very curious your opinion, but one thing it's for sure is neurons don't divide. So something like DNA methylation is very much can cause all sorts of mutagenesis. So many of the mutations that arise spontaneously arise at C to T transitions, where methyl C accidentally gets read as T during DNA replication. So it is mutagenic in general, which is why there's very few CG dinucleotides in our genomes. And so you would imagine that more methylation in general is bad. Organisms don't all use methylation the same, probably because it has significant evolutionary costs. But now if you're in a cell that's post-mitotic for 100 years, what do you care? Well, you're not going to divide. Okay. So go ahead and use methylation to control the genome. So it's thought that it's maybe a rheostat. It's a factor that can set levels of expression, for instance, rather than necessarily turning genes entirely on or off. It's one possible hypothesis. No one is exactly sure.
I think I would say that neurons have to express a number of genes very precisely, mm-hmm. and they probably want to not express a lot of genes also very precisely. Mm-hmm. And much of neuron's job is essentially to stay the neuron and to only turn on the very few correct genes at the required timing. Because if a cell cycle gene gets activated in the neuron, you have a real problem on your hands. And that would be my guess about what's really different about neurons, because other cell types have to turn on half of their genes throughout the cell cycle, if not more. And neurons probably don't. And where I would guess much of our understanding about neuronal activity and neural diseases will go soon, if it's not going there already, is the understanding of the fluctuations of this expression noise, gene expression noise,
yeah.
in the neurons during the normal development and disease states. Because I would put a lot of money on the fact that changes in the noisy gene expression would be associated with massive neurodegenerative diseases and neurodevelopmental diseases. Because if something's wrong with chromatin, what is the readout of that? Well, if you're lucky, it's the readout of a very specific pathway, which you can publish as a Nature paper. But more often than not, it is just random genes that randomly go up at the wrong time in the wrong place.
Yeah, or not even random. I guess it's just the fidelity of the process,
right? That is,
you know, there's no question whatsoever that. So one of the things that I'm on a tear about this right now, right? We use at this current time patterns of gene expression to define cell types, and in the brain, we're really into defining cell types. Like the most recent, you know, science article, I forget, but everybody's talking multiple thousands of cell types that they want to define. But we also know that gene expression in neurons changes in response to the environment. That's how neurons adapt their function. Now, they don't change every gene, right? They have to change the right genes at the right level such that the cell can keep functioning in the way that it's supposed to and yet modify its functions in the way that it's supposed to. So it's a coordinated process. Maybe that's kind of what you were saying before. So I'm not sure that it's completely random, but there's this process that has to be orchestrated or coordinated.
I think
when disruption in time or disruption in magnitude could actually have a really significant effect on how the cell responds.
I think when it becomes random, then you have a problem in your hands.
Yes.
That would be my guess.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the idea of fidelity. So what keeps it faithful? I mean, what's controlling it and making it not go haywire?
Chromatin.
Well, and feedback loops.
And feedback loops chromatin. Chromatin is the rheostat. It's the stability mechanism in the cell. The cell wants to keep expressing genes it's expressing and wants to not express genes it's not expressing. And there are many, many, many feedback, feed-forward loops to keep what's on, and what's off. And it's quite hard to push the cell into a different fate. You have to overcome this Waddington landscape in terms of like just the free energy of the cell, because you have to remodel.
But see, you're talking about fates again, and I'm going to push you, and I'm going to say, but we have to talk about states, right? We have to not only talk about fates, because yes, this neuron needs to remain a neuron, but it needs to be an activated neuron versus an inactivated neuron.
For instance. It's a sub-fate.
It's a state. Just as self-cycle, so
I think part of the question is, like, during development, is the thing you're talking about, this faithful controller, is it sequencing out a series of things, and things are popping off and popping on to make chromatin accessible and inaccessible in an organized sequence that creates the sequence of the neuron's life? Or is that...
It is very ordered, and I would say an example I can come up with, this is the other example I was going to say when we started talking about FOS. The place where we know this very well is actually in the development of motor neurons. So there was a beautiful set of work that was done looking at development of motor neurons and other neurons in the periphery, just sort of looking at identifying all of the transcription factors expressed in those cells and the order in which they turned on. And there's been beautiful papers where you can take stem cells and differentiate them into muscle, into motor neurons, for instance, and watch the patterns of transcription factors that are expressed and how each one, there's been this beautiful sort of handoff model. The pioneer factors will go out and they'll open up chromatin regions, but then they're going to turn off. But they can co-bind with other factors, which then can bring in a third factor when it becomes turned on. And so you can see these handoff processes happen between one program of transcription factors and the next. So early in development, it's absolutely positively, you know, one transcription factor turns on, it has a certain half-life of its activity, and also, I mean, so there's all these feedback loops, right? It's going to degrade over time. Eventually, a lot of these turn themselves off. They have autoregulatory pathways. But once a cell becomes committed after this stage where you become, say, a certain kind of motor neuron, then it tends to be signaling pathways. It's just like FOS, right? It's activity-dependent signaling pathways that end on a transcription factor like CREB and alter its protein-protein associations. That's actually becomes the trigger and the time and the signal that something should change from one state to the next.
During development, cells have the luxury of dividing. And as they are dividing, every time they are dividing, they undergo this massive reorganization of chromatin just by sheer numbers of chromosomes that they have to replicate. If you are not replicating your chromosomes, it's a lot harder to remodel the chromatin landscape, because then the nucleus is set and there's already so much going on. Everything is bound to everything. Mm-hmm. And you don't have the energy to rebuild, essentially. Mm-hmm. So that's the difference between, I guess, the fate and the state, right? So I guess you go from fate to state. And within the state, you can
fluctuate,
and within the fate, you can fluctuate. And we know that from Yamanaka's experiments, right?
Yeah. So this is what's fascinating, right? So obviously, one of the holy grails in neuroscience is, could we take neurons and revert them to an earlier state? Could we fate reverse them and then send them back down a new path? Could we take, you know, when we've lost our dopamine neurons in Parkinson's disease, could we take some other neurons that are there that maybe we don't need so many of them and turn them into dopaminergic neurons? Would that be possible to do? And it hasn't yet been possible to do. I don't know if you have any ideas about how you would do that. And why can't you do that? You can take, for a long time we thought you couldn't do this, but we know now you can take a skin cell, a differentiated fibroblast, and you can turn it into a neuron. You can turn it directly into a neuron. That's amazing,
yeah.
Right? So why can't we turn a neuron into a fibroblast?
So that means none of the things that we're talking about, even the fate things, are irreversible. Everything is reversible.
We don't know in neurons. That's a pretty tough
thing. Nothing is impossible. It's a matter of numbers, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not a quantum physicist, but I heard that theoretically you could pass through the wall. It's just your every atom of yours has to pass through the wall. The odds of that would be really low.
Okay, well, if I think if cell fate is in that category of irreversibility, then that's irreversible to me.
Yeah.
The passing through the wall is too rare of an event.
Right. Well, on the Yamanaka note, though, the original experiments, conversion rates were very, very low.
Yeah.
And so even the expression, ectopic expression of these three massively important transcription factors, four massively important transcription factors, the odds of getting the right colony were 1%, 2%, 3%, no more than that. And so on one hand, it tells you that transcription factors can drive conversion and cell fate changes. But on the other hand, it tells you that chromatin
they don't usually
is really not letting them do that very well.
Yeah. And so, it would seem like in neurons, it's got to be the unique features of the chromatin that are really what's repressing the ability to reverse fate, because neurons are harder to reverse than many, than any other cell type, but than many other cell types, for sure.
Well, thank you very much. That was great. I really learned a lot. I think it raised my interest in whatever's coming next in this field.
Thank you,
Anne.
Thank you.
And Alexei.
Thank you.
And this has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.